Hello, good evening, and welcome to the TNT show. Hey, I'm John Drummond, and I'm your host for the next 60 exciting minutes. Thank you for joining us this evening. We have yet another great guest tonight, and I'm really excited that she's with us. Stay tuned to hear from an accomplished singer and all-round entertainer. I'm a big fan, but also an avid independent supporter. Now to our guest. Tonight, the nation talks to Eddie Reader. Eddie's latest album is Cavalier. Make sure you get Cavalier. Make sure you do. How are you, Eddie? How are you coping with the pandemic?
Yeah, I'm coping well. I'm okay. I think I was saying to somebody today that it brings in all the tenement woman training, you know, the bleaching and the cleaning and the ironing and the feeding and the recipes. And I've just turned back into that. So I rely a lot on that and I'm glad of it.
Does it make you feel uncomfortable or do you feel you welcome the change?
I quite like that people keep distant. By this time of year, I usually catch about 5 or 6 viruses. And I've been health, touch wood, I've been, you know, clean bill of health all the way through it. And I mean, I know people that have caught it and the actual big one, COVID one, and not survived. So it's a warning, but I think we have to relax in that. In a little way that, you know, as long as we're safe in our house and we wash and we clean and we keep decent, we're all right. Get through it.
But you're an entertainer, you're a singer. How do you cope with that change? Because I assume before this happened, you must have had a whole bunch of gigs planned and all of a sudden that's all gone and you're at home. I mean, what a change.
I know, but I like it actually. I was working so hard last year and doing Jules Holland gigs and my own tour, and then my own tour again was coming up, and I thought, "Oh, geez, I hope I've got the energy." And it's nice to just have this break. It's like it's like imposed, you know, sit down and shut up for a minute. I'll be right raring to go next year, though. I do miss them.
Now you've got a whole program planned for next year.
Yeah, that's been put in again. I mean, who knows if it's going to happen? But if it does, I'll be there.
Great. Great. Well, that's very good news. Tell us a little bit about your background. Tell us about Eddie Reader, where you were born, where you grew up.
It's a big old story, but I'm a tenement lassie. I was born in Anderson, Glasgow, and I was born just at the end of the 50s. Okay, I'm not a 50s baby, but I'm 59 August, and I have vivid memories of that street in the tenements, and somebody was painting the pictures of the tenements today on Twitter, and I wanted to say, you know, there's something amazing about being able to look up at these massive, what looked like mansions to me, and all these women leaning out of the windows and other characters, and just feeling watched and nurtured and cared for and minded. And that community was great. You know, I had my granny in number 23. We were number 7 Anthony Street. My granny was 23. We all kind of shared the toilets and everything. So I was so pleased to have that background. You know, my auntie Mary, my mother's oldest sister, would chase me away from her doorstep because I would always be walking across the street for biscuits and sweeties. And I just remember the pavement and the cobbles and the stones up on in the staircase were the size of up to my shoulder, so I could remember climbing with my wee legs trying to get up these stairs, and my granny was on the third floor. So I think that I love the fact that my granny was there, her sons and daughters were all around us in different houses, and my mum and dad got their first place when they were 22 and I was coming along, and it was this place just on the corner of Argyle Street, and it had one single door. We didn't have a close, and we were supposed to use the toilets down there and the other close, but they were filthy and the close was full of alcoholics, so the toilets were kind of broken. And I fantasized about everything in that street, the broken glass, the purple and lilac water of the oil on the puddles became Mary Poppins pictures, and the broken glass became diamonds, and the, you know, the dead rats became the evil monsters. that we managed to survive. It's just, I love my history. I remember just being the favorite one, the youngest daughter of my grandmother's new daughter. And I was just treated like a princess. I was the curly haired angel.
Were you spoiled?
I don't think it's spoiling a kid giving it everything he wants. I have the attitude that you don't spoil them. You only spoil them when you don't pay attention to them. And I was paid attention to. Oh God, I was loved by granny, granddad, aunties, uncles. Everybody wanted my attention. In fact, they had a big falling out about it. Like, I was spending so much time with my mum's mother that my dad's mother got a bit upset, and they had this big row. Don't let her in the house. Don't let her come for you. So there was a big fight for ages, and I didn't know why I was kicked out. Like, get across that road and help your mother. I was about four. And she had another two, you know, and my younger sister, Gina, just remember her sitting in the dirt of the back of the house and the bins in Anderson and the tenement bins. And I remember just leaving her sitting there and going across to get a biscuit. And oh my God, my mother came after me like a bat out of hell. And that is a big memory, you know, just this kind of, I've got duties.
Yeah. Well, you know, Brian Cox told us that he first started performing, as it were, when he was very young, because the family were looking for something to do this sort of stuff. And he says, I just loved it getting up there. And they would stand me up in the table in the sink and say, right, do your thing. This is at New Year and stuff. When did you start singing for the family? And
I desperately wanted a guitar. And when I was about eight, my cousin Alan, big cousin Alan, was a show band player. He played, he was in the army, I think, and he kind of played in a band at the weekends, electric guitar, rock and roll and all that. And him and cousin Janet, who used to babysit for us, he'd come and babysit and he'd play and he'd show me things. And I adored Alan Stobo, his name is, and lives in Girvan now, out of Glasgow. But he taught me how to tune the guitar and tunings and like Joni Mitchell tunings. I didn't know who Joni Mitchell was, but I knew what tunings were. And when I was 10, I kind of bleated on about it enough, and my dad and mum got me up, went up the Barras, and they got me a guitar, and it was in a coffin-shaped cardboard box, but it was tiny. And I just played it and played it and played it and played it. I was in the toilet. I'd lock myself in. Everybody would be queuing outside, battering the door down. I'd be in there practicing, hurting my fingers with the D and the C and the F and the G and the C and the A minor and the E minor and the D minor. And I'd be kind of working it all out. And I adored my guitar. My guitar and me were like constant companions. I would never be seen without it. And even going into school, I'd take it and I'd store it. I'd bring it out and play what I'd learned, which was basic, you know, by ear. My granny also had a piano, so I could pick out tunes. But I never really performed for them until I learned Millie Molly Mandy on the guitar. And I started playing Millie Molly Mandy, sweet as sugar candy, pretty little eyes of blue. Everybody would be if they only could be walking out with you. And I think it was some favourite of my Auntie Grace, my mother's sister-in-law. And she was like, I'm taking heart of that, Shuey Green. We are going on opportunity knocks. And nobody is stopping us. She's gone, he went. And the only person I'd noticed was on Opportunity Knocks was Lena Zavaroni. And I was like, no way. I ain't doing it. And I'm not meeting that dodgy effer. Yeah. He looked a bit weird to me, that guy, Hugh Green. I just was in love with playing, like learning songs that were in the Hit Parade, the Archies, Sugar Sugar, and all the songs that they all sung at parties. I would accompany them. My dad singing Elvis, my mother singing Peggy Lee, Wishing Ring. I would sing harmonies. I'd force my sisters to do all the harmonies to Bye Bye Love. Consequently, Jean, my sister, can only go, there goes my baby, with someone new, and she hates me for it. No, she doesn't. But it's like, I can't sing that song without doing the harmony. And so I'd do that until I was about 15. But when I was 8, there was one big, massive moment when Belinda, in my class at school, who was the favourite girl, she had eyelashes that were an inch long and stopped her sleeping at night, according to her. All the boys fancied her. And we were in an extracurricular class called Mrs. McDonald's knitting class, where we learned to knit little purses with buttons and a triangle lid. And I was just treated in school like an nonentity. I had socks that fell down all the time and had to be kept up by elastic bands because I had twigs for legs. And I also had egg on my breakfast was always showing somewhere around. And then what happened was Mrs. McDonald, who had a massive black bouffant like Amy Winehouse, she didn't particularly like me, but liked all the good girls, all the girls that did things like Scottish country dancing and knew how to win an argument. And when I would just go, And I think she put this suggestion to us all that we learn a song to sing and bring it in on the Thursday. So consequently, Belinda sung, "All kinds of everything remind me of you." So she did that. And another lassie, Lorna, did "May you never smile at a crocodile, may you never tip your hat and stop bowing." And in my head, with my guitar, I knew that I could blow their minds if I could only be brave enough. So I put my hand up one Thursday and I said, I want to sing. But I didn't bring my guitar in. I'd got my dad earlier, before he went to work, to write out with his oil-stained welder's hands, he wrote out quite dyslexically all the words of "Love Me Tender." And so I sung that, all 6 verses. And I had my hands at the back of my head, leaning on the blackboard. And when I opened my eyes at the end, first of all, there was a kind of shocked atmosphere, and then an applause, and then break bell went, and Belinda and Lorna and all their pals and all their boys wanted to walk me down the street. "Come to my house and play. I've got a new Barbie doll." You know, you've been kind of in. And I realized there was a power in it very young.
Yeah.
I also got lots of compliments if I was doing the clothes. I'd be washing the clothes, and the neighbors would hear me singing, and they'd give me threepence or tuppence or something. Yeah. Just for the nice song hen. So I kind of got affirmation that way, not through my family in that way so much, because everybody sung in my family. So yeah, there was nothing special about me. It was only when I was 15 and I'd learned "House of the Rising Sun" on the A minor and the E minor. "And there is a house," and I belted out because I really wanted to be Janis Joplin, but I sounded like Ariel from, you know, Little Mermaid. So I couldn't quite get that transition into rough and ready singer, blues singer. So, but I did scream a lot then, and I like screaming my voice out. And yeah, so that led to kind of meeting people and busking and braving that bit, that little step between me and the standing out and putting my hand up. That was what I've always had to deal with, like busking or going into a studio or going on stage. It's that same feeling. You have to just get over it and get it done. Get your hands behind your head and shut your eyes and do it. So I've got better at it, I think.
So what was your first step into a sort of professional career as opposed to singing, because people like to hear your voice? Actually,
what are you calling that? Are you calling that making money?
Well,
busking then. So busking was my first. I went to Sucky Hall Street, just outside British Home Stores, where the corner of British Home Stores was. Is that Buchan Street? No, it's Sucky Hall Street, and across from Cut and Dried, the hairdressers. And I put the case down and I just started singing. I'd gone with Croft and Bobby, another couple of buskers who taught me about the cinema cues. But I didn't want to do that because it felt a wee bit like I was encroaching on other people's space.
Yeah.
All I wanted to do was just, if people came and they paid, that was lovely. If they didn't, that's lovely too. It didn't matter. But just wanted to experience this like thing I could do that people kind of stood back and went, what? What's that? And I enjoyed that so much that I used to do it every Saturday. And the first Saturday I earned £30 in 10 pences and 50 pences. And £30 when the dough money per week was £27.80. Yeah. So it's kind of amazing. I was like, what? So I wrote Glasgow Star about it, which is about walking down the Great Western Road on a tarmac wave because I was so high with this idea that I could just get free money.
And then you found yourself subsequently at some stage in London.
Yeah, London, then back home, then France, busking. And then London was really shit for busking because everybody was so down at heel. And maybe it was a bit threatening in the tube station. There was a few people would offer you a fiver for a sexual act rather than give you money. And I'd be like, oof, do you think I'd be doing that if I was doing that? You know, doing this, if I was doing that. You know, and also I met a few people that were kind of following me home and it didn't feel very safe.
Yeah.
And except there were times in that tube station when my voice felt like it was in the tenement again. And I could see people at the bottom of the stairs just lingering with their ears up, just kind of liking what I was doing. And it was, I think it was the funeral of Lord Mountbatten, that guy that's the uncle to the prince. And this guy with his badges and his bells and his whistles and his lapels, an old dude in a walking stick, heard me singing. And he came up and he was battering his stick against the wall and going, what are you doing? This is so disrespectful. This day has been the man's honor. You are besmirching and blah, blah, blah. And I just started talking like I was from Northern Ireland. And I said, well, I lost my brother in Northern Ireland. What do you think about that? Anyway, well, I didn't mean anything, miss. He just gave me £2. And then some dudes down in the bottom stair were going, leave her alone, you old fart. And then there was other guys, like boys, you know, North End boys.
Yeah.
They'd be like, oh, I bet you're really rich, right? You're really rich. You come down here and you're just playing music because your father's giving you a bit, big bit of money. And I was like, no. And I would just stare them out, like, say, you know, Hayley Mills and Whistle Down the Wind, I'd just stare them out and they'd leave.
Yeah.
But so it was a powerful thing to have this vocal ability. It seemed to change the atmosphere every time I was in danger, it saved me. Every time I felt bored, it saved me. So I was kind of in the throes of it and going wherever the telephone call said, you know.
Did you feel that was a great grounding for actually becoming professional?
People would get thrilled by deals and bigger companies coming to see you, but I just knew that it wasn't a be-all and end-all. Having a record deal wasn't a be-all and end-all. Having great success wasn't the be-all and end-all. You had to maintain a certain integrity for the work and the sound that you're making. It was so important for me to nurture that I loved making money with it, you know, doing a bit of backing vocals and all that on Eurythmics and Alison Moyet and all that. But I kind of got bored with doing that because it's kind of easy to do that for me. I can go in, do it and come out and you will be impressed by the harmonies and all the work that I can do. But it didn't leave me with any satisfaction of what do I actually want to say? What is it you're trying to do here? You've got a voice that sings, but what do you really want to reveal yourself to people? And I realized that I wanted to find songs that I could deliver like a postman, really, just tell you what the emotion is so that whatever it is that softens my heart would then soften yours. And hopefully, cokeheads didn't really like what I did because it always annoyed them that I made them feel something.
We've got some questions coming in now, quite a number. I'm going to save some of them for later, if you don't mind, folks. But here's one that might strike a chord. Anne Obelock, sorry, Anne, if I mispronounced your name on Facebook. Our question is, Eddie, can you remember the shop Rita's in Glasgow in the 60s when we used to get taken to get a new coat for Easter?
Every woman wants as well, shoes. Oh, my mother hated taking me for shoes because she got it on the coupons. And then I think there was some deal, wasn't there? You saved up and then you had a big splash out. And I'd go down the Barras with her. I mean, the Barras were great. They're a bit dodgy as well. I got felt up in the Barras when I was 11. I was a bit kind of worried about the Barras, but I do enjoy it. All markets, Belleville in Paris, Petticoat Lane in London. And I think we should nurture Glasgow's market. Yeah. But Rita's, geez, to get those black patent shoes, I drove my mother nuts to try and get a new pair of shoes. She had seven of it. She had five girls and two boys in the end. So that was, and I was first in the queue, so that was good. Then Jean got, when I was finished, the linoleum cut, you know, covering over the hole.
So you became a professional. You were a backing singer, and then you became a professional on your own right as Eddie Reader. What was that like, that transition from being in the background to you being the star up front?
It's difficult for me to use those judgment terms because I don't, but I think I never felt unequal to anyone. I knew I could do something. I didn't walk about thinking that I had something that made me special. I just thought that I had something that I could do. And I was a bit frightened of all the lawyer speak and the manager speak and the agent speak, and it just wasn't my world, and I was in it, and I knew what I had was making the money. I was just emotionally connected to what I did. I wasn't pragmatically connected, if you know what I mean. I didn't see it as anything special. I just saw it as something that I did, so I couldn't barter myself. Whatever came along, I tried to go with what was the next best feeling, and the next best feeling was always, what's the next song?
Yeah.
I heard Martin Evans songs. I thought, that's the next best feeling. Let's go for it. I had definitely managers and agents and people that were interested, and record companies that were interested, just because I was working with the Eurythmics and Alison Moyet and all that. I had a step in the door.
So you spend a lot of time on the road, I take it.
Nowadays.
Yeah.
Well, for years, I didn't know how to make money with singing. I knew how to busk, I knew how to do sessions, but once we became number one album, number one record, triple platinum in many different countries, it became a thing that became more like, you've got to do this and you've got to borrow money to do it. Yeah. So at the end of the year, what you earn is taken off of what they've spent. So I found that I couldn't work live because it was too expensive. I was having to borrow 50 grand just to have decent sound and lights. And of course, nowadays it's different, but I'm worried about all those people that work for musicians because they're in trouble right now. There's nothing to fall back on. I can sit in here and create on tape, but a light man has to do lights live and sound man has to do sound live. So I kind of realized that if I cut it right back and it's just me and one other person, then I could make a living. And I found in the later years now that I can do that with four or five people, just cutting out all the agent and manager. And
That's cool. We're almost at the halfway stage and I haven't taken one single question. So people have been getting uptight.
I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize, please. It's great, you know. And I want to ask you about your grand or your great uncle shortly, but let's take a few questions. Otherwise, we'll be upsetting all your fans who want to hear from you. But they're mostly political, but here goes. Several folks have asked, Eddie, do you find that supporting independents has affected your career or your record sales?
No. I never pay attention to career or record sales, so I wouldn't know. I just follow my heart and go for what's logical. If it upsets anybody, I can't do nothing about that.
And that was a question from Sean Collins on YouTube. And it was also, again, from Sean, and also Ruthie Dixon is asking.
I'd like to know why people think having a binary choice as a citizen, a yes or a no choice, why it would affect anybody's work that you choose something. I didn't know. Nobody told me I wasn't allowed to want yes. Am I not supposed to be allowed to have a choice as a citizen? But there was a woman up in Ullapool, I think, somewhere up there. This guy, this American fan of mine, he said, I was in Ullapool. And this woman, she was selling your record in the shop. And she said to him, Eddie Reader's good, but no sense she's falling in love with that Alex Salmon. I didn't even know who Alex Salmon is at that point. You know, I just made a choice. It was like, what is wrong with people? It's the whole I like Rangers or Celtic all over again, isn't it?
It's a bit polarised, yeah. Bryce Herbert on YouTube is asking, Eddie, when did you first decide independence was for you? What was your foremost reason for? Most people who support independence, it's part of a journey. They didn't start off that way. You know?
Yeah, me neither. Me neither. And I was brought up with folk clubs in the 70s, so I know that the SNP were considered Tories and tartan Tories, they were called. And so I had an inbuilt aversion to anything that was SNP because it was explained to me they were people from a different class, they were different, they had different politics. And I didn't really understand it as a Labour, traditional father, grandfather, great-grandfather, Marshall MacLean in Glasgow. So, I'm an egalitarian, first and foremost. And it was only when I was asked the question and came home to live in Scotland, somebody said yes or no. And I then just asked what my dad would ask or my granddad would ask or his brothers and uncles and all the people in the shipyard would have asked, what's the deal? What do they get? What do we get? How does it work with the votes? And once I got all those questions answered, it was the 27th of February, 2012, and I'd been asked the question from 2010-ish. So it took me that time to ask all those questions and find that my newspapers and my books and my Google didn't really have the answers. How many lords are there? How many people? What is the representation of Scotland? I didn't even know we had 59 MPs.
Yeah.
So it became a learning experience. And then once I found out that 59 representing my country, my place of residence, 59, they're a representation. And I found that in a sea of 850 lords and 650 MPs, commons they're called, in that hierarchical system, I would never use that language, but people do. I found that we were 4% represented. The 59 in a sea of 850 and 650 is 4%, and we are 8% of the UK. So I found that out first, and then I asked, because I don't mind paying for a Mancunian singer with two kids like me, and I don't mind her paying for me. So that's where I've been always brought up. But it was when I realised that what we're given as a vote in any general election, when I lived in England, my vote could contribute to the majority in England.
Yeah.
Now that I live in Scotland, I pay the same tax. My vote cannot. It can contribute to a majority in my own country, but it cannot affect anything that ultimately governs me, and I find that abhorrent. And I now look back with my great uncle's words that I inherited in 2012, and I've now been given a kind of lesson on our history and how gaslit I've been all my life. Why do I know more about King Arthur than I know about Scathach, the woman from the shadows of the land of Skye? Why do I know less about my Celtic background than I do about about anything that's happened, the Tudors, the, you know, it's just a bit weird to me that that's been allowed to continue. And I saw that the Labour people that I voted for, by the way, which were Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, I just saw the futility. I just realised, oh my God, even if all of Wales's 40 MPs and all of Scotland's 59 were added together and all of them were Labour, it would only add to their Labour average in England, which is about 191. Yeah. So if 191 and 99 are added together, the Tory average in England consistently is 300. So how can we ever have a say in our own lives? And that they control, we have devolution, we have certain things we control. I'd like somebody to give me the list. Why don't you give me the list? If I was married to you, I'd want the list.
There's a question here, thanks for that. A question here from Ruthie Dixon on Facebook. She says, hi, Eddie. How do you feel Nicola Sturgeon is handling the pandemic?
Fantastically. I've never known such a conflagration of we need and we get. So we've got this person who's able to hold her own with the bravery that I've never seen in a Scot. By the way, I've seen posh Scots. I don't think Nicola's a posh Scot. I like the way she uses the word whiz instead of was. I like the way she talks. I like the way she's straight. I like the way she's direct. I know she comes from Dreghorn. I know she was 14 when I had a number one. I know I came from that area and I was at that school that she was at, Greenwood Academy. And I know that that girl has seen what I've seen. She's seen her father out of work. I saw my father out of work. I saw total degeneration of towns and villages in Scotland, never being invested in. And I think that for a wealthy nation, which I know we are, that that's abhorrent. And I would like to be in union with England. I am a unionist. I would like to be in union with England, but not this deal. This deal is rubbish.
Yeah. Here's a question you might like. Alex Cochran is asking, would you ever think about writing a biography?
Yeah, I occasionally try little, as I said to you earlier before we started talking, I have to stretch that muscle a wee bit because I don't feel confident enough about the written word. I know how to tell a story, but I don't know how to do it in words in the paper in that way. So I have to get a bit more confident about that and figure it out. But I would like to, because I think there's a lot of things about being a female in a quite a macho society that I managed to witness and feel equal to all people that were in my company. So I don't know where that bravery came from, but I know it's something to do with Glasgow shipyards. I know it is, you know, something to do with the sandstone of the buildings and just the patter and the way people treat you.
I just find that fascinating. Well, hopefully you'll take the chance to write something.
Yeah, and also for other singers. I mean, basically, people sing, they're like Olympians to me now. When I hear what they learn, they know how to sound like tuners. They know how to manipulate their vocal cords in ways that I don't think people were able to only 20 years ago. It's kind of fascinating to me how, you know, a musical ability is nurtured these days, whether you're female or male. I find it egalitarian. A lot of lassies kind of go, what do you think about the macho behaviour? And I go, you want to take a step back to 1978 with me? Where the folk clubs in Scotland and England were a little bit weird. For a wee lassie and a guitar. But, you know, I got through it.
That's cool. Ruthie Dixon is asking, we've got quite a lot of musical talent within the indie grassroots movement in Scotland. She mentions Amanda Brown, Brooke Coventry and the Graham Brown Band, and Pete Scally. She said, would you ever consider getting together with them, maybe doing a song? Or maybe say, for example, there's another referendum coming up maybe next year. Is that something you might be
interested in? Well, it's always about work, and if the work is good, I follow, but I have to listen to work first, no matter who it is. It could be Elton John. Yeah. The song's shite, it's shite.
Would you consider writing something yourself?
Maybe. I mean, but I don't have any control over that. I just kind of go, please send me some inspiration. I just do that and hope, have a bath, smoke a fag, go out in the garden, dig a hole, try, then something might happen, you know.
I think maybe what prompted the question was when we were talking with Brian Cox, he plans to come back if there's another referendum. And Alan Cummings has already signed up to do the same thing. Is that something you might be interested in if there is another referendum, joining a platform of people, say, from show business and elsewhere, entertainers?
Yeah, I did do that. I contributed to the Usher Hall gig. That was fantastic. I felt so wonderful being in that company. I noticed there's some infighting with some of the independent people here, which flummoxes me, because I know one thing, Tories never, never split. So unless you are prepared to compromise and put away your grievance, you have to go for the main prize at all times. Just focus. Indie, then we get the menu of choice. Yeah. It opens out like a fan. So I don't think Better Together has ever stopped campaigning. So I've never stopped campaigning, and I won't ever, because I don't think it's fair. And I don't think anybody from Dudley would notice if the pipeline to our own money just stayed here and we dealt with it than going down south. I don't think anybody from Didsbury, Dudley, Hatfield would even bat an eyelash if Scotland were dealing with their own money. And it's all about the money. That's all it is. Yeah. It's not about social union, which is indestructible. It's not about the royal union yet. And it's not about us breaking up anything. It's about having a different deal with each other. And I believe in the wise nations, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, England, all of Ireland, all of Scotland, all of England, all of Wales, coming together but autonomous of each other. And I believe that's important. The wise nations of the former United Kingdom.
I think these are wise ones, if you don't mind me saying so.
Add Isle of Man to that and you've got I'm wise.
Tell us a little bit about your, is it your great uncle or your?
Yeah, James. Seamus Reid. James is my granddad's half-brother, and I never heard about him. I just used to hear people at parties saying to my granddad in quite a joking way, hey, have they found your brother yet, Dan? And then they'd all laugh. No, they're still looking for him. And it was 1969 or something like that. I used to hear those conversations. He passed away in 69. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know the funeral arrangements, nothing. I just remember that this guy was important and he was in Ireland, and his son, my dad's cousin, James, young James he was called, he was a radio officer for the British Army, and he was, then he joined he was a radio officer for the BNI lines going between the countries of Europe and Ireland. And I got to know them by just being in Ireland doing gigs. They lived in Dublin, James with Molly. James had been born in Glasgow. He was 8 years old when he was hid in a lifeboat. He was stowed away with his mother, who was from Denniston, and he was at St. Mungo's, and he was stowed away in 1934. And the next thing he knew was he was in Dublin and he was in school there. And it was to do with the fact that Ireland had made a treaty with England, or an Anglo-Irish war was finished, and but they didn't tell the people here who'd been working for the Irish independence movement. And what the Free Staters in Ireland did with this agreement was that they had to inform Britain about everybody that might have been involved in the Home Rule movement for Scotland, in the independence movement for Scotland, in the socialist movements for Scotland. So there'd be spies at John McLean meetings. There'd be infiltration of groups of people like the Scouts, the Irish Scouts. And there was a roundup in 1923. And then my uncle, as I've now discovered in his writings, there was a gunfight in Glasgow Green and a gunfight in Kelvin Grove Park. And I think a lot of them here realised that the independence movement that was starting here, they were trying to ask the Irish to help as as the Scots, about 4,000 Scots, helped the Irish get independence, which the Irish ignore and the Scots ignore because we're part of a union. We can't talk about it. So what happened was that he was sent as the commander of the Scottish Defence Force. He was sent to ask Dan Breen if they would help Scotland become free of the empire. And he says in his papers, "I knew that the answer would be no. Absolutely not. We've got a deal with England. We can't afford to go to war again. So we're just accepting it the way it is." And that was his start of living in Ireland, 1934. And when James died in 2012, I thought I was going to be getting just some family pictures, maybe my granddad's dad. I didn't know. Seamus was my granddad's older brother. What I got back was pages and pages and pages of documents and letters and writings from this woman in New York who was calling my uncle an old comrade, and here's something from Patrick Pearce, now keep this safe, and letters to James Connolly, and James Connolly talking to my uncle as a 18-year-old boy, and him being arrested for a couple of pistols that they found that he that's in someone else's house that he took control over. And all these words like that about a Glasgow that I had never really experienced, but only had a hint of, when you think of the men in the shipyards and how quiet they were and how taciturn everybody was with their kids, and don't talk about that in front of the kids, no in front of the Wains, don't bring it in here, no party songs, no football songs, just keep it all quiet. And kind of this sense that all the men in my family had some won over on the authorities, like they all knew something that the authorities didn't. And yet the authorities, like the local police and all that, would be in their houses and at parties getting little bungs from their bookies runner activity. So there seemed to me in Glasgow, what he's revealing to me is this Glasgow that was honeycombed with dissent, honeycombed with radicalism, honeycombed with meetings about how to better life for the working man or the working poor, of Ireland, of India, of everywhere, of Scotland, of anywhere that was controlled by an empire, that they were allowed. And there's a beautiful thing he says in one of his books. He said, I was 12 and I was the captain of the Baden-Powell's scouts, and we went up to Wallace Well and Rob Royston up there, and he said we all sat down and under beside the Wallace Well, and we all made a vow that we would nurture the people of the city we love, which was Glasgow. And I don't think they make them like that anymore. these boys. I mean, he was 18 when he was arrested.
Yeah.
And the story he tells me is, I met Captain Carmichael's mother, and you're thinking, Captain Carmichael, he's bloody 18. You know, I couldn't ask my son to boil the spaghetti at 18. Never mind, get Ireland a country. But they were real people, and they existed in Denniston, Bayliston, and they worked so hard, and they kept undercover. They risked their lives for Ireland, and just because they wanted that they believed that no small nation should ever suffer occupation. And I think that's pretty righteous. And that was coupled along with the fact that we were being asked an independence question. I was kind of like, what? Okay, let's, this is me being educated. And I went with it, and I love what I've learned. I've got a few snippets of things that I think I could tell people. I took it up to Glasgow Uni. They're going to turn it into the history departments of Scotland. Hopefully I can give it to them and they'll look after it. I'm going to see about writing my own journey towards this. I think it'd make a great telly programme, but I don't think the BBC will touch it.
I shouldn't think they would, but who knows? You never can tell.
Well, the Glasgow historian at Glasgow Uni said that it takes 100 years for it to become history, and it's now become 100 years.
Yeah, yeah. And well, the other thing too is that the victors write history, so, you know, who knows what might happen in the near future. I think that's a great story. I think you should press on and committed to fighting if you can.
What I love about him more than anything is none of his grandparents or parents were Irish. None. None of his great-grandparents were Irish. And he was born Episcopalian. So, you know, his father went to the same place as Keir Hardie went. You know, that was the religion that they followed. So he wasn't in any way Catholic. It was nothing to do with Catholicism. It was nothing to do with being Irish. It was to do with being an egalitarian Scot, and many were like him. Yeah. And I love that I come from that. And I had to read through it before. I didn't want him to be a murderer. I didn't know what he'd done or something to do with Ireland. I only knew about the IRA in the 70s, so I don't know. It was scary to me. And also, he has one, you know, my dad's surviving siblings want to read it too. And I said, well, I'm going to check through it that there's nothing dodgy in it. And all I see is a man that is dedicated to making sure everybody's life was better. He became a theosophy student. He learned yoga. You're talking 1920. He joined the Rosicrucians. So he became Master of Liberty in the Rosicrucians in St. Michael's in Dublin. And he brought up his son, and his son was as baffled as me. He was given a military.
I think it's a great story. I think you should write that. I really do.
But I think my granddad was upset with him because the stepmother, my great uncle's, my grandfather's mother, I don't think they got along. Might be to do with the police coming in and bayoneting our house to bits at 3 a.m. looking for Seamus. It might have been something to do with that.
Tell us, what sort of future do you envisage for Scotland? Looking at the situation right now, and bearing in mind the sort of power grab that we've learned about today, where it would seem that there are plans to effectively abolish Holyrood through various devices that allow centralisation and allow, for example, Westminster to ride roughshod over the wishes of Holyrood and to operate from Westminster. Give this new legislation gives ministers the power to act without consultation, literally without consultation. And even if there is any consultation, they're not bound by it in any way, shape or form.
Well, so that's good. They're making it really clear what the situation has been for decades.
Yeah,
we're ignored anyway. Scots in London are like ghosts. MPs that go to London are like ghosts. They walk about in those corridors with their cigars and their booze. They've got about 15 different pubs in that place. Everybody's out their face. Everybody's inviting them to party. That's the situation. Since 1707, Scotland have been down there playing the role of doorkeeper. They're just opening, you know, there's nothing that they do that is of any value to anybody in that house. And so therefore, this is them just making it writ large. So I don't know, if I was a no voter, I'd be kind of, okay. I did notice that about the no vote, because I was a no. No, I want to share everything. And then asking questions, I became, well, maybe that's not very fair. Oh, that's a shame for Scotland. Oh, wait a minute, Scotland doesn't get a say. Oh, huh? What do we control? The road signs?
Yeah.
Right. I became maybe, then yes, then hell yes. And you don't go backwards. You don't go backwards. There's nobody I know that's going backwards. So every no that you know is gonna, or frightened, if they're frightened, if they're scared of change, this is gonna help actually see what the problem is, you know. And it'll English understand it, because they just think we're leaving them like we're pals. I have to explain to my English family and friends, look at what's happening. We don't have any say. And I pay the same tax as you. You've got say. I don't have any say.
Yeah, very good point. Just tuning into that passion that you just expressed there, several people asking is, would you consider being an MSP?
I don't think I'd be any good at that. I'm not a legal brain. But I'm an emotional brain, and I will grab you by the heart and I'll batter it until you're soft. Yeah. And
that's what's needed, Eddie. Maybe that's what's needed.
Well, I don't know. I met a lot of no people, and I said, what's your problem with it? I think we have to ask more questions and listen more, because there's a lot of people are just frightened of change, and I don't blame them. if you see the spectre of having nae money, when I did a gig after the independence vote was no, one of my fans shouted at me from the stage, "We've got nae money, Eddie." So you've been trained to believe you're nothing. You've got nothing. You've got no way out of it. You've got a big bill to pay. You won't be able to get past it. You can't even get out your house without feeling poor and irrelevant. So unless we sit and listen to people and allow them to express their fears and then try and assuage their perceptions a wee bit and try and just point out to them that they're not going to stumble.
Yeah.
We're going to be there. Every single person is going to join in with this journey. There's no way one of us is going to fall. We're not going to let that happen. I'll make the soup.
Yeah. here's
I'm back to tenement living, you know. I'm back to tenement living.
Fantastic.
When we were
we're going to hold you to that. You're going to make the soup. Here's a question from Miriam Gordon. She said, "Please, Eddie, could you create a song around that story you just told? It would be amazing."
I've used a lot of his. He was also a musician, my great uncle Seamus. So he collected. This is the bizarre thing. When I was reading the papers, I didn't know, of course, my great grandfather, his father, my granddad's father, Charles Reader. And I'm reading about him from this guy's perspective, who was, you know, 18 when he died. My granddad was 9 when he died. So I'd never learned anything from him. But from Seamus's papers, it says, and this is 2012, and I made a Burns album in 2002. It says, "My father, my good father, sang Burns songs in every lodge in Scotland. And his father played the concertina. And his father came from Germany and was busking in Leith in 1850. And I'm like, who am I? I'm this person that's made up of all that DNA and political and spiritual and emotional, and I'm going to hold on to it till my last breath, you know, because I enjoy the passion of debate and I enjoy Twitter. Nobody insults me. You can say, and you're like, nobody insults me. They're not powerful enough.
here's a quick question. We've got 5 minutes to go. Here's a quick question from Peter Murray. And Peter Murray is saying, "Hi, Eddie. We busked in Paris at the same time. What was your favourite pitch and was it successful?"
I remember. What he's got to tell me is, what songs did we do together? Because I'll remember that.
He said, "Did you enjoy being a Scot in Paris?"
I did. Because I got kicked out of a pizza parlor place because the football hooligans from England had been in the week before and destroyed the place. So when I was in there, they thought I was Anglaise. "Va faire foot, Anglais, sir, yeah, grab me by the back of this thing." And I was out that door until my friends all went, "Elle est écossaise, she's Scottish. Mademoiselle, je pardon. Voulez-vous une big pizza?" Yeah. So being Scottish got me a pizza. But Rue Saint-Michel was my busking place. And I loved Paris. I love France. France was my first stop. I fell in love with France. I love the egalitarianism of the place. You know, there isn't the hierarchy of lords and ladies and I'm better than you because I've got more money than my granddad. So I didn't have to do any work. You know, that's a weird system. Weird, mentally ill system. Woo! You think somebody's better than you because they've what? Got 20 quid more than you. Right, okay. Get therapy.
Get some help, yes.
It's a hard system to be living under, because I lived in it and I know that people are cowed by earning power and cowed by status and cowed by hierarchy.
Yeah.
Just, I think it's sick.
Yeah. Do you have much contact with people in the SNP, MPs, MSPs?
I think at first people were interested in me because they thought maybe I could get to folk or whatever. But I've always kind of maintained my my impartiality. I'm not a member of any party.
Yeah.
My vote is free. If you do something crap, then I'm not going to vote for you. But certainly if I want the prize, which is independence, I'm going to have to just bank all my desires for spending money on everything.
And yeah.
All the vulnerable, the weak, the poor, the old, the sick, the yeah. needy, the ones that need it. I want them happy, because if they're not happy, I'm not happy. It's the same as feeding your kids. If yeah. one kid's getting and the other one isn't, it's not tenable. So I'm going to vote for SNP until we get through that door, and then I'm going to see what's on offer.
Okay.
Keeps me a citizen.
Yeah.
Rather than a political pundit or anything. I'm just a citizen that believes in all people. I love no voters just as much as I love yes voters. In fact, I love no voters so much I want to give them a country.
Well, thanks for that. I appreciate it. We're almost at the end. Our time's almost up. It's been absolutely fantastic, Eddie.
Thank you. I'm so glad
you were able to find the time, because passion is one of these things that translates. It goes through a screen. It comes off a stage. It's there. And when somebody has it, people feel it. They empathize. They resonate. Thank you very much for that. And please remember and buy Cavalier, folks. A big thanks to all of you out there for joining us. Thanks for your questions. And very importantly, please, please support Indie Live and the folks who make shows like this happen. It's not by accident. There's a lot of work goes on behind the scenes. So help Indie Live, please. Thank you again. Good night, all.